DS106 Radio. If you're there, so are we. This is Emo Boiled, formerly known as Hard Boiled. And we're going to discuss Walter Mosley's Devil in a Blue Dress tonight. And that should be fun, because that's a great novel. But before I do, why doesn't everyone, or the half of us who are here tonight, say hi?
Hi.
Hi.
What up?
Oh,
yeah.
Paul Bond.
You got mentioned in the Paul Bond post. Paul Bond.
He linked my blog to it.
Yeah, he did. Paul Bond's awesome. We're going to talk about him.
I was really excited.
It was actually the post called The Tangled Web We Weave,
yes.
Right? Is that the one?
Yes, it is.
And he linked to you, too, Jesse, but you didn't give his track back.
Yeah.
I don't know, because you also don't have subscribed to comments.
I haven't got to my email. I just don't check my email out.
Okay. And I know there's probably 5 million spam in your thing, because you didn't do Akismet.
No, I did do that.
Breaks my heart. Okay. Okay.
Did you see that I made an About Me page?
I did. I'm loving this. Week 15, you guys are on the bandwagon. It's great. It's unfortunate that the class is over.
Not yet.
But this is the beginning of great things. What you've taken from Hard Boiled or Emo Boiled, now you go and you spread your seed far and wide. Okay. More seriously, yeah, so I love Paul Bond's post. He's doing what I probably should have done all semester, but like you all, I was just staying above water, and I understand that to some degree, that it's not easy. But this way, he brings everything together between the post Brenner wrote about the Joker to you're going into the real details of the Black Dahlia case, to you're talking about the Zoot Suit, to Jesse's talking about the flower and the Glasgow smile. Which brings me to an interesting point. I was talking with Jessica about this before the class started. Now, the Joker has come up at least 3 times, and I'm talking about the Joker specifically from The Dark Knight, right? And let me ask you, why do you think the Joker from Chris Nolan, right? Is that his name? Chris Nolan's The Dark Knight. Why do you think that keeps that coming up in this class?
Because everyone loves Heath Ledger.
Heath Ledger. What happened to him after that?
He's still dead.
He OD'd.
He's still dead. He OD'd, right? Some people say maybe suicide, right? I don't know. He's having a hard time.
Yeah.
But apart from his personal life, why does that character and why does the kind of Batman trilogy come up?
It's our time. Extreme.
It's our time. It's extreme. Right? It's a kind of...
Well, it's current. Because the other
current
just came out.
That's right. You guys have seen it. You can relate to it. And we talked about, and Sarah did a great series of blog posts about, and, you know, just to give Sarah a shout-out here, I mean, she did a great series of blog posts in which, so there's Brenna's crazy Joker, right? And I want to talk about your post too, Maureen. But the one here that's interesting to me is, you know, well, there's Jesse's Black Dahlia. That's what the actual flower of the Black Dahlia looks like. And I'd never seen it. That's really, it was really a kind of beautiful detail to bring in and kind of give some nuance. And obviously the great Paul Bond, as Sarah noted, already found all this. I was late to the party. But we'll talk about some of the, and we'll listen to some of the book, but this kind of not only visual note-taking that Sarah's done, but also just following up on some ideas that she had about history and stuff. To me, blogging is a lot of different things. There's no one way to do it. But if what we're doing here as college students and as thinker has any value, the value is not saying what we talked about, because we talked about it. That was our conversation. I hope the value of this is some curiosity is born, and you file through on the ideas that kind of excited you and go with it. Whether it be the Glasgow smile, or how this class relates to Heath Ledger as Joker, I'm interested in that. And I bet you are too, and I bet you'd be a lot more inclined to write about what you're interested in than to write about what you think I want to hear. I don't want to hear any one thing. And I bet you most people who ask you to do something like that don't want to hear any one thing. They want you to be passionate and thoughtful about what you're interested in and relate it back to the things we're talking about. And it's really kind of a beautiful sense of that when going through Sarah's notes and her murders. There's really been a beautiful sense of that in a lot of your posts over the course of the semester. So don't take this as, oh, it's finally coming. I mean, I'm hard on my classes on purpose. I give you a lot of work, and I ask a lot of you because I think it's important that this is the time that you feel the pain. Right? You're not going to have a time like this at college for 4 years, for an extended period of time, to think long and hard and be asked to do so much in such a short period of time. And it's stressful, and you have social lives and everything else going on. But this is the time where you lock in and you think and you imagine and you dream and you write and you do whatever you do. But it's a privileged time, you know, and it's a good one. And it's worth the time to take it. But anyway, before I get off on that horse. So why does the Joker come up? Brenna, we talked about your post with the Joker, and it's come up a few times. Jessica Martinez has talked about the Joker earlier when talking about Bruno, that maniac. Remember him from Strangers on the Train? So what? Why does the Joker come up? You guys said because you know him. What else?
He's insane.
He's insane. It's a new kind of insanity. How does he feel about morality? Right? What does he say? Remember that scene when him and Batman... You know, he says, we're freaks. They don't understand us, right? He has that moment where he's trying to kind of frame the whole question of why Batman's morality is completely off, because he plays into a game that he'll never be a part of because he's a freak like the Joker. And then what about that other scene? One of the craziest scenes in the film, I think, when we have the Batman wannabe. Remember that? What happens with the Batman wannabe? Because we've heard about wannabes in the Black Dahlia. We talked about that a little bit. What about the Batman wannabe?
Doesn't he go crazy?
What happens with the Batman wannabe? Remember from The Dark Knight? Anyone remember
when
the scene?
He pulls out the gun, and they're like, Batman doesn't use guns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
he gets attacked by dogs.
Okay, I'm thinking maybe of the wrong one. I'm thinking of the one.
Is it the one,
the one with the mask?
It's the one where, remember, he's on TV?
Oh, yeah.
And he's got the guy on the chair? And he's like, hey, Batman! You want to see? You want to see? And he's going all crazy. And he's got the guy. This guy thinks he's you. And he's got him in this kind of like YouTube-like video. And it's on, like calling Batman out to say, Batman, come here. And he goes and then basically ends with the guy screaming. And it cuts off. And there's this real kind of dark realism. And that's what's so haunting to me about the Joker. He's such a dark, insane character. But at some point, you connect with him. Whether you want to or not. But we haven't talked about it yet, but I think it's interesting that it's come up again and again because, you know, that, of all three Batman, that's the one that's closest to kind of the violence and hard-boiled noir. I think you could really make a case for that. Batman as a series, particularly The Dark Knight, is very much in the tradition of the violence and the noir we've been writing about. So it's interesting that, for you guys, that comes up again and again. I'm with you on that. I mean, I think it's a kind of a very nice, but also with the Glasgow smile that you guys nailed that. I mean, it's interesting. Both you and Jesse were talking about that same thing. It came up again. So it's interesting to see these things kind of emerge. And that's part of the connections that I think should emerge on a thoughtful piece. All right. But a couple of things before that. And we're going to talk about the Wikipedia project towards the end of the class. But I want to start with talking about Devil in a Blue Dress. This is the book. And the 1995 film was made by a director called Franklin, who's, I think, a great director, greatly underrated. This is a brilliant film, and you'll be watching it on Thursday. But Carl Franklin directed another movie called One False Move. In 1992. Has anyone seen it? It's also a noir. It's considered a great film noir, and I think it is, at least of the 90s. And it has, like Devil in a Blue Dress and like Walter Mosley, the themes of race at its core. And very similar to the themes that come in A Devil in a Blue Dress. And One False Move, for me, has a lot of the kind of raw violence that you see in, say, The Dark Knight, or some of the later, or even in Elroy. It's a very kind of hard movie to watch, but also really powerful. So Carl Franklin directed the version of Mosley's film, Devil in a Blue Dress, and you'll be watching it on Thursday. But anyone do any research on Walter Mosley? Anyone know anything about this character who we're reading? Or at least not the character. The character is Easy Rollins, about the author that we're reading. Anyone? Bueller. Bueller? Bueller.
So I started reading the wrong book.
You started reading the first 50 pages, right?
Yeah,
the short story?
That,
yeah, I figured some of you might. I should have said something. I didn't think to. But It's yeah, the Devil in a Blue Dress actually starts on page 46. So, yeah. Sorry about that. Although now you're some the wiser and you can tell us about Crimson Stain, which is a short story. I don't know why they put it before Devil in a Blue Dress versus after, but
just so this would happen.
Just so this would happen, exactly, for this very moment. Anyone do anything about Walter Mosley? Your research? He's an interesting character. He was born in Los Angeles, and he was born to a Russian Jewish mother and a black father. And so he, in some ways, has this kind of very interesting history, right? And his story, and we'll talk about that, kind of reflects some of his biography. I don't think nearly as kind of intensely as James Ellroy, but there's definitely some of his biography that comes out in this. But Ellroy was not a writer until he came to his 30s. He was actually a computer programmer in the 80s. And he went to City College up in Harlem. And his mentor said, you know, given your background, you came from a poor family, your mom's Jewish, your dad's black, you should be writing stories. In many ways, starting in the 30s, he actually started. And this was his first novel, published in 1990, Devil in a Blue Dress. And E.Z. Rollins, like kind of V.I. Warshawski, became one of the most popular characters in noir, and still is considered. And we'll talk a little bit about E.Z. Rollins. He's a great character. But, you know, Walter Mosley himself is fascinating. He was actually, he was brought up in Los Angeles. He now lives in New York City, but he was born in Louisiana. And there are some kind of references to the South, particularly Louisiana, in the book. But he's got this kind of mix. And Sarah, you said on Twitter, talked about his description of the South. And I'm actually intrigued, too, by that description of the South, particularly about Houston. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the book, right? What about, oh, Leo, you're going to come in and stir me, right?
They said they beg my pardon.
Okay. We just talked about Walter Mosley's mother, who is?
Russian.
Russian Jew.
Russian.
Yes. And,
like me.
And actually, there's a point, there's an actual point in the book where he talks about the relationship of what happened in Holocaust and his play in the World War II and the relationship to what he calls in the book, or E.Z. Rollins calls in the book, Negroes. So we'll look at that specifically. But it's hard to escape the question of race in Walter Mosley's book. In many ways, because the universe we're used to, the white universe of the 40s or even of the 20s with Hemingway, or the 40s with Mildred Pierce, or even the 30s with John Fante. You know, we step out of that for the first time in the 60s with Cotton Comes to Harlem. But it's a very different vision in some ways than that of Devil in a Blue Dress. And why? What are some of the differences right off the bat between something like the book Devil in a Blue Dress and, say, Cotton Comes to Harlem?
There are people of all different races and nationalities in Devil in a Blue Dress, whereas in Cotton Comes to Harlem, everybody's black.
Yeah, it seems to make a point of that, too, right away, from the Indian to the Chinese, the two guys who work for Albright, right? One of the things that's interesting is the racism may not be as bad in Cotton Comes to Harlem versus Devil in a Blue Dress. One of the things I found right away is the difference between the books is, Cotton Comes to Harlem, who do you got your main characters as?
The detectives.
Gravedigger, Coffin Ed, right? And they are what?
Black.
They're black, yes. And they're cops, right? They're in position of somewhat of power, and we've talked about that a little bit, about that role reversal, right? When we come to Devil in a Blue Dress, what about E.Z. Rollins?
He's like an elementary school teacher. No.
No, that's Crimson Stain. Stay with that one. Good shot, but no. No, he's not an elementary. Scratch that on the radio. He's not an elementary.
He just
school
got. He doesn't have a job.
He doesn't have a job. What happened?
He was fired.
Where was he working?
In a factory.
In a factory. That's right. Airplane factory. during the war, right, post-war, at the airplane factory, you have the airplane industry, which is exploding, right? So it kind of places us in a time and a place, right? And then he's unemployed, right? And who is his employer? Well, first of all, he works for a factory, and he likens working for a factory like working on a plantation, and we'll look at that. But there's also this scene that, unlike Coffin Ed and Gravedigger, there is no power, right? He's not in a position of power. He's not a detective yet, as he says in the book, right? He's kind of a guy who kind of needs what? What does he need?
Money
to pay for his what?
Rent.
His mortgage. Yeah, it's important that it's not his rent, right? Because this guy has a sick fantasy love affair with his house, right? He'll sit around drinking bourbon, dreaming about getting spam mail. You know, what would be the equivalent of spam mail, like marketing mail?
He's just really proud of the fact that he owns something.
That's right. There's a sense of ownership and pride. And I totally kind of really come and respect that. But there's this beautiful moment that's around which how this happens. And there's this question that kind of starts to unfurl in this book around questions of money, questions of capitalism, and of course, at the core of this, questions of race. But I want to go back to Brenda's point about the racism in Devil in a Blue Dress not necessarily maybe being as raw as that in Cotton Comes to Harlem. Because for me, in some ways, the racism, or what is the perceived racism in Devil in a Blue Dress, is completely different in that the universe has a different center now. You know, even in Coffinette and Graveyard, it seemed like you in Harlem that you had a universe that was kind of all black, right? But in some ways, they kind of stood between that power structure. And as many people said, they were kind of almost placeholder characters. They almost were like caricatures, right? But in this, we have our universes completely switched, right? It starts with Easy Rollins, and he's the center of our world. And in fact, when white people come into the narrative, they're in many ways, as we've seen from this perspective, the outsiders, right? And that violence, according to race, in many ways is still there. It has everything to do with Easy Rollins' personal history, his history with Mouse, his history in the war. But there's this kind of interesting switch whereby we start to see the world from a very different perspective, right? We're looking at LA, Los Angeles, which is the center of the noir, not from the perspective of the white Mildred Pierce, or of the Italian John Fante. We're looking at it in retrospect from that of the black Easy Rollins. And it's kind of a very different vision. And part of that vision is owning your own house, having your own space, you know, getting mail. You know, and then part of that vision is also the world in which you live in the 1940s, right? And there's a lot of interesting kind of moments there that we can think about. So let's do that. Let's go and look at a couple. Not Crimson Stain, but Devil in a Blue Dress. Let's look at, we talk about, and there's the point, there's not, and Jillian's point on page 61, there's not just black or white like you had in Cotton Comes to Harlem. There's very one or the other. You have Sharif, who's an Indian, as they say, or Manny, who they're not exactly sure, but they think is Chinese. Like, there is that kind of racial ambiguity, which actually is a lot of what the story centers around, right? Even more so than moral ambiguity. Because I don't think Easy Rollins, you don't really get the sense that morally he's corrupt, right? He always seems to have some moral center. And nothing is more American than saying, I want my own little piece of property. I want my own little land, and I'm going to fight for that, right? That's the dream, right? And that's kind of interesting how Easy Rollins comes so very cleanly into that dream, very squarely within that tradition, right? But obviously with a whole different set of concerns. So, and let's look at that. I mean, that's all over, and we can look at that to some degree. But let's go, we'll look at property. I want to get right away where we start dealing with the questions of race as it comes out. Let's go first paragraph, first chapter. I was surprised. Who wants to start to see that? This is chapter one. This is on page 45. I was surprised to see. Anyone? Yes, Sarah. Thank you.
I was surprised to see a white man walk into Joppy's bar. It's not just that he was white, but he wore an off-white linen suit and shirt with a Panama straw hat and bone shoes over flashing white silk socks. His skin was smooth and pale with just a few freckles. One lick of strawberry blonde hair escaped the band of his hat. He stopped in the doorway, filling it with his large frame and surveyed the room with pale eyes, not a color I'd ever seen in a man's eyes. When he looked at me, I felt a thrill of fear, but that went away quickly because I was used to white people by 1948.
You're good. So, let's stop for a second. 1948, interesting, right? That's the same year as what? It's a year later than Elroy, right? So, like Elroy, this is historical narrative, right? Taking place back at the same point, right? So, we kind of have, it's interesting, back to back in the 80s. This was written in 1990, Elroy 1987. We have these historical fictions going back. And Maureen, you brought up, what the hell is up with 1990s people being obsessed with the 40s? And you brought up The Sandlot, and this kind of idea, at least when you're reading The Big Blow, which I love that you're reading. And that's a really good question. What's the obsession with the 40s and the 80s and 90s? And that's one we can come back to, but I haven't forgot it. What do you make of this description, Leo?
It's, in general, it's very interesting how people are kind of trying to connect their current life with their, with like, their past life, something that they lived before with their memories. And everybody has like different memories of 40s.
Yeah.
So that's why, for example, descriptions in some of the books and understanding of the racism is shown from different perspectives, because all of these people kind of probably hold different social and positions and had kind of, you know, opinion on this question quite, you know, in a different way.
Well, it's interesting, too, and if you think about what you're saying, you know, Chester Himes decided to write about the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different political moment than the 40s. And what does that give? I mean, how does that change the narrative that Mosley said, I'm not going to write about the 60s or the 80s. I'm going to write squarely about the 40s. Right? What is that? What particular elements does that fill with his character? Like, what do we know about Easy Rollins?
He's like World War
II. In the Army. He was in World War II, right? And that defines a generation. And that particularly defines the generation of the kind of 40s and 50s noir characters, right? That horror they saw, not unlike Hemingway in World War I. I know how you love Hemingway, Jillian. I mean, that vision of horror that they, and that comes up again and again in this narrative. And that's important. So there's that. But also, what about the question of the moment of the 1940s and, say, race? Yeah, Sarah. It was now, but Prohibition ends about 33 or 34.
Yeah, but it talks about how the bar was like still around.
That's right. And the gangster, the whole evolution of the gangster
yeah.
is still like, that's what we're seeing in Albright,
and
right?
And still like the effects.
Yeah, and we have that. And that gangster hasn't gone away since the 20s. That's a good point. How about the question of racism, though, in the 40s? What does that give Mosley? Gives Mosley a kind of a moment to kind of explore race in a different moment, before civil rights, right? What it might mean to talk about race in a culture that's segregated, right? I mean, this idea that he says in the first paragraph, I was used to white people by 1948. He's not 1 year old, right? He wasn't born in 1947, hence I'm used to them. How old is he? Late 20s, 27? I'm used to them, so 27, what would it mean for you to say, okay, I'm 27 years old, I'm finally used to black people? What would that mean? That would mean you had entirely lived a parallel life to them, right? In which the two worlds had never come. And that's kind of, from the very first paragraph, the world of Easy Rollins. And what about this description of Albright? What about his name? Let's talk about names for a second. What's his name again? DeWitt, and what's his last name?
Albright.
Albright. You think that's allegorical? Albright, all white.
Oh.
What about his, how his description is? Let's look at his.
White linen suit.
A white linen suit. What else?
It talks about like the whites of his eyes.
The whites of his eyes. Pale white eyes. What else?
The Panama straw hat.
Panama straw hat. White silk socks.
There was something later where it said like his black gun was the only thing.
It's the only thing, right? Black gun. I mean, talk about, I mean, Mosley really with the imagery right off the bat is playing that question of white and black and that segregation and how stark the two seem at the same time. And I just love it. I mean, bone shoes. Ugh. bone colored shoes. I mean, how many synonyms could he get for white in one paragraph, right? I mean, Albright is, you know, the symbol of everything white walking into this black bar. And it's very interesting, the kind of that immediate moment, that's where the struggle, that's where the tension begins, and that's where the story starts, right? And that you have, you know, Easy Rawls brought into this kind of crazy moment. Now, there's a bunch of interesting scenes. One I want to talk about specifically, and it kind of gives us a sense of this kind of segregated moment in the 40s in which Mosley is kind of recreating historically, is that scene on the pier. Who remembers it? He's going to the pier in Santa Monica, right, to meet with Albright, because he has the information. Albright wants to meet him. And what page is it? Let's find this. This is on page... Yeah, good. Perfect. It's 99. Awesome. From 98 to 99. And he basically, what happens there?
He's going to meet Albright, and he's just like standing on the pier, like looking out. And there's like a group of like teenagers, like white teenagers, hanging out. And one of the girls comes over and like talks to him. And like she's the one who's initiating the entire conversation. And like you can tell that Easy is like kind of a little tense about it, because he knows that like things will happen if he like interacts with her or whatever.
Yeah.
And so then her friends are like drunk, and they like start yelling at him, so they like surround him, and then Albright shows up.
It's interesting, and I think, Leo, you're the one who blogged about Emmett Till earlier in the semester. And the story of Emmett Till is a horrific story, right? A young black kid from Chicago, down in the South, says the wrong thing to the wrong woman, and is beaten to a pulp, dead, to find his body. I mean, it's part of history. I mean, you know, and that's a frame for Cotton Comes to Harlem, but this is also a frame we're seeing. Think about this moment for Easy. He's on a pier, he's doing everything he can to avoid her, knowing that as soon as that happens, as soon as that contact that he didn't even want, he's immediately the attention of violence, right? And a power structure that he cannot win in. I mean, let's read it. It really is a powerful scene to recreate this question of segregation. Let's start it. It's on 98. And a chubby girl. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Jesse, read loud and proud.
A chubby girl in a tight-fitting skirt wandered away from her friends. She was younger than the rest of them, maybe 17, and it seemed like she was the only girl without a date. When she saw me, she smiled and said, "Hi." I answered and turned away to look out over the weakly lit shoreline north of Santa Monica. I was hoping that she'd leave and Albright would come and I'd be back in my house before midnight. "It's pretty out here, huh?" Her voice came from behind me. "Yeah, it's all right. I come from Des Moines in Iowa. They don't have any things like ocean back there. Are you from L.A.?" "No, Texas." The back of my scalp was tingling. "Do they have an ocean in Texas?" "The Gulf. They have the Gulf." "So you're used to it." She leaned on the rail next to me. "It still knocks me out whenever I see it. My name's Barbara. Barbara Moskowitz. That's a Jewish name." "Ezekiel Rollins," I whispered. I don't want her so familiar as to use my nickname. When I glanced over my shoulder, I noticed that a couple of the young men were looking around like they'd lost someone. "I think they're looking for you," I said. "Who cares?" she answered. "My sister just brought me because my parents made her. All she wants to do is make out with Herman and smoke cigarettes." "It's still dangerous for a girl to be alone. Your parents are right to want you with somebody." "Are you going to hurt me?" She stared into my face intently. I remember wondering what color her eyes were before I heard the shouting. "Hey you, black boy, what's happening here?" It was a pimply-faced boy. He couldn't have been more than 20 years and 5.5 feet, but he came up to me like a full-grown soldier. He wasn't afraid, a regular fool of a youth. "What do you want?" I asked politely as I could. "You know what I mean," he said as he came within range of my grasp. "Leave him alone, Herman," Barbara yelled. "We were just talking." "You were, huh?" he said to me. "We don't need you talking to our women." I could have broken his neck. I could have put out his eyes or broken all his fingers, but instead I held my breath. 5 of his friends were headed towards us. While they were coming on, not yet organized or together, I could have killed all of them, too. What did they know about violence? I could have crushed their windpipes one by one, and they couldn't have done a thing to stop me. They couldn't even run fast enough to escape me. I was still a killing machine.
Good. What do you make of this? What situation? What does Easy do?
Nothing.
he holds back. Right? Why?
He doesn't
kill children. One reason. The other reason might be also because, right? If he did anything in this situation, whose side is the law on?
White side.
Immediately, right? I mean, he's in a no-win situation. He's starting to think, can I jump off the pier and live? And he's looking behind him, thinking that that's his only out. And it's interesting, I love this scene because he's not looking for it, he's just waiting for Albright. He talks on the car coming from Compton over to Santa Monica, saying basically what? Anyone remember? I don't go to the white side of town at night, right? I only go there during the day, and that's where the factory is, but I'm comfortable going there, but not at night. And this is kind of this, you know, it's a reality I don't think we can really fathom. And it's a perspective that we really haven't seen in our narratives yet. Harlem was the narrative of Chester Himes, and that world was entirely a vision of that. But it was also 1965 when these questions were coming to a boil. In 1948, this wasn't a question. It was a reality, this segregation. And E.C. Rawlins gives us a really kind of a powerful look at the horror of that. Now, another thing about this book, when is this book being written? Look at the front of chapter 8, 97. One of the interesting things that Walter Mosley is doing here is very subtle.
1990,
right? That's when the book is published. But the question, and it's an interesting question, is where is E.C. Rawlins speaking from? E.C. Rawlins is the narrator, right? He's giving us the story. But there's these strange moments, like at the front of chapter 8. There was still a large stretch of farmland between Los Angeles and Santa Monica in those days. The Japanese farmers grew artichokes, lettuce, and strawberries along the sides of the road. That night, the fields were dark under the slight moon, and the air was chill but not cold. He's going to Santa Monica.
Is it 1960?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different... He's writing... The character of E.C. Rawlins is actually writing in retrospect. Now, there's another moment when he talks about, that's the moment I became a detective. And in fact, the whole narrative is not happening in real time. It's E.C. Rawlins telling us the story of his start. And then it's hard to realize that until you start getting deep into the novel, and you know, Mosley's giving it away piece by piece, that this is a novel written in retrospect. Almost in some ways, like Mosley is writing this about a time he could never know.
Inception.
He was born, exactly, Inception. He was born in, I think, 52. So it's not a point that he could kind of even relate to. So it's actually an interesting narrative device that he's pulling in right away. And we can talk more about that. One of the things I thought was interesting, you remember a guy named Paul Bond? Paul Bond actually did a really cool thing. He was reading this book, but he was actually reading the book on the CD. He was listening to it. And he had a couple of posts about what it means to listen to a book on CD and how the narrator of that book kind of takes over, right? Kind of like if you're sending a text in class, the narrator takes over. You know what I mean. But anyway, the actual bullet point here is he actually found and took off some clips from the CD for us to listen to it. And it's pretty cool. To listen to it. So
it's weird if you're listening to a book on tape and the narrator has like a weird accent or something.
Yeah. Well, look, here's a good one. This is the scene on the pier with Albright. So let's listen to this.
Excuse me, Mr. DeWitt Albright said again. He was smiling. What do you want? The footballer said. DeWitt just smiled, and then he pulled the pistol, which looked somewhat like a rifle, from his coat. He leveled the barrel at the large boy's right eye and said, I want to see your brains scattered all over your friend's clothes, son. I want you to die for me. The large boy, who was wearing red swimming trunks, made a sound like he had swallowed his tongue. He moved.
Why do you laugh? I'm just interested.
His accent.
His accent? See, that's him trying to be smooth, right? Yeah. Well, wait, you think that's funny? Wait till Carter is reading. Okay, we'll get to that next.
Moved his shoulder ever so slightly, and DeWitt cocked back the hammer. It sounded like a bone breaking. I wouldn't move if I were you, son. I mean, if you were to breathe too heavily, I'd just kill you. And if any of you other boys move, I'll kill him. Then I'll shoot off all your nuts. The ocean was rumbling.
I'm glad this isn't humorous to you.
Rumbling, and the air had turned cold. The only human sound was from Barbara, who was sobbing in her sister's arms. I want you boys to meet my friend, DeWitt said. Mr. Jones. I didn't know what to do, so I nodded. He's a friend of mine, Mr. Albright continued. And I'd be proud and happy if he was to lower himself to fuck my sister and my mother. No one has anything to say to that. Now, Mr. Jones, I want to ask you something.
Yes, sir, Mr. Smith?
Do you think that I should shoot out this nasty boy's eyeball?
I let that question hang for a bit. Two of the younger boys had been weeping already, but the weight caused the footballer to start crying. Well, I said after 15 seconds or so, if he's not sorry for bullying me, then I think you should kill him. I'm sorry, said the boy.
You are? Mr. Allright asked.
Yes.
How sorry are you? I mean, are you sorry enough?
Yes, sir, I am.
You're sorry enough?
When he asked that question, he moved the muzzle of the gun close enough to touch the boy's tiny, flickering eyelid.
Don't twitch now. I want you to see the bullet coming.
It's a great line.
He just made DeWitt, like, into a creepy pedophile.
DeWitt as creepy pedophile.
Who is the one speaking high voice? Is
that was Albright? DeWitt. That's Albright DeWitt. And Albright DeWitt, I mean, he does have this creepy... I mean, but this might be the writer, too, because he has this creepy high voice. Later on, we meet Carter, who's this crazy rich guy who's actually on the hunt for Daphne. He's in love with Daphne, and it's kind of how this whole story. But listen to him. And this is interesting. Actually, we could follow, because I really like Paul Bond's thread here. One of the things that we already mentioned it for a second, and we will listen to them, but we already mentioned for a second, but let's go back to E.Z. Rollins and his story. He loses his job, right? He was working in a factory. Why does he lose his job?
He said he didn't
want to. Said he was too tired, basically, to work an extra hour, right? And because of that, he was fired. And he was like, screw that. But again and again, we hear he needs a job because he's got to pay his mortgage. So let's go back to chapter one when we actually have Joppy. And who's Joppy?
His bartender,
heavyweight fighter, you know, and we come back, Joppy. Joppy's the one who's his friend. He gets him hooked up with the deal, right? And Joppy introduces him to Albright. Albright is looking for who?
Daphne
Monet. And Daphne Monet is the kind of, you know, she's the figure that this whole narrative is operating around. Everybody wants Daphne Monet. That's who Albright's after. That's who he's asking E.Z. Rollins to go get. And that's also who we learn the rich venture capitalist, Carter is in love with. So she's kind of in many ways the center of the narrative, at least the object of affection of the narrative. All right? So let's go on page 46. Where are you from, E.Z.? Mr. Albright asked. Houston. Houston, now that's a nice town. I'm on the bottom of 46 going to 47. I go down there sometimes on business. He smiled for, oh, sure, maybe I should act it like the reader. Houston, now that's a nice town. That's not very smooth. I consider him kind of like, Houston, now that's a nice, I don't know how I would, it's funny, it's like, when I read a book, and I don't know if you're different, do you have the voice in your head?
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, sure. His voice kind of makes me think of,
I always hear what?
The killer.
You always hear what?
Voices.
You always hear voices, yeah, okay.
I was gonna say, it reminds me of the character from No Country for Old Men that I the
yeah.
Same character. I mean, obviously not the same voice, but like the way they talk, or at least how he made him sound. Like,
yeah, very.
I think I should blow out his stinky eye, his dirty eye.
Yeah, I mean, there's a. I don't hear like I'm serious. When I read, I don't hear voices.
I never hear
I
voices
see the
in
text,
my head.
You know, I don't hear voices. Emo boil. Don't hear voices. But it's interesting because it'd be hard if I were to someone to say it would be a great assignment. Actually would be a great assignment if I'm looking, because I'm looking to do this class again where we have more of these media assignments. I just didn't have time.
I don't know how you can, like, determine that, because, like, I've heard that all your dreams are black and white, but when you remember it later, it doesn't
seem different. So I don't know if I can actually.
Well, you should just like assign.
But you're reading. So
well, like,
you
I can
think
hear,
about
like,
it when you're
voices,
reading?
But I couldn't, like,
no.
Like, I couldn't say anything.
So what do you think about an assignment where you basically say, would this be an interesting assignment? You have to actually record the voice of a character.
To
act
yeah.
it out.
I had to do that
no,
in my drama class freshman
point.
Year, and it was not my favorite project.
It wasn't?
No.
I feel like they should just have to blog like an actor. Be like, this character's voice would be
yeah.
Brad Pitt because blah, 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 blah.
Match
blah.
A character. Who would play that character
yeah,
in the role?
Yeah.
I mean, because Denzel Washington is brilliant for easy roles. Brilliant. And Don Cheadle plays Mouse in the movie. So that's actually right, yeah. Who, what character, who would play what character would be a better way to go? But I'd actually like to hear you all make fools of yourself sounding out your voices.
Yeah, that's what we didn't like about it.
Yes, exactly. All right, so on page 46, Up closed his eyes with the color of robin's eggs, matte and dull. You ever seen a robin's egg?
Yes.
It's like the lightest blue you can imagine, the pale, it's crazy. He worked at Champion Aircraft up to 2 days ago, Joppy said when I didn't answer. They laid him off. Mr. Albright twisted his pink lips, showing his distaste. That's too bad. You know these big companies don't give a damn about you. The budget doesn't balance just right, and they let 10 family men go. You have a family, Easy? He had a light drawl, like a well-to-do Southern gentleman. And there was no drawl in that, either. It's interesting, because they're describing the voice. Not just me, that's all, I said. No, just me, that's all. But they don't know that. For all they know, you could have 10 kids and one on the way. But they let you go just the same. And then Joppy says, that's right, shouted at. Joppy shouted. His voice sounded like a regiment of men marching through a gravel pit. Them people own them big companies don't never even come into work. They just get on the telephone to find out how their money is. And you know they better get a good answer or some head's gonna roll. Mr. Albright laughed and slapped Joppy on the arm. Why don't you get us some drinks, Joppy? I'll have a scotch. What's your pleasure? Usual, etc. And that's one of the first kind of introductions to Albright. And the topic of their conversation is what?
Somebody's listening to our audio thing right now. Just saying.
Okay.
People are tweeting about it.
Tweeting about it. Sure, they're listening. We hear you out there. But more importantly, we know you're listening. We hear voices. Yeah, emo boiled. It's all about the creepy. Okay. But more seriously, what's the topic of conversation? Who's the bad guy? Factory owners, the big companies, the man, right? And interesting, Easy Rollins relates the idea of working in a factory to working on a plantation. And there's this point, very interesting, also relates back to Indemnity Only. The idea of, what is kind of V.I. Warshawski? One of her things is she's an independent contractor, right? She's free. One of the things that Easy Rollins himself also comes into the fact is that he can work for himself as he kind of comes into his idea, I'm a detective. Is that he's somewhat free. He says he had his first notion of freedom when he realized that he actually can do this detective work. Right? So there's this interesting point where he kind of stands up to the Italian foreman who just wants him to kiss his ass, basically. And he says, you know what, I'm not gonna. You know, I'm gonna work for myself. And there's that sense of independence that's born out of it. But also always in relation to the man or capitalism. And there's this great moment later on where that vision of capitalism comes back. And I love this point where they start talking about money. So let's take a look at this. There's a point at which the idea of money comes up. And he describes not only with the house, and we see how much he loves the house. And, you know, the house is his ability to have his freedom and his sense of pride. And they talk about...
That kind of reminded me of Joppy, his marble...
Yeah. I love that. It's funny. I really related deeply to Joppy constantly cleaning the marble. I have a table, which was my mother's table from the 1930s, actually my grandmother's table, and my mother has passed. And so my kids and I, we eat at the dining room table every night. And when they do something to the table, I'm like, your grandmother would be pissed if you did it. I'm constantly fixing the table because it's like my connection back to my sense of my mom and that connection. But I love that character, and that's just a rich characterization of Joppy, and it makes him come alive.
It's like he went back to, I think, Texas.
Yeah.
To get it to his new bar.
Yeah. And it's like that's him and that's his, and you know, it's one of the things that Rollins really respects about Joppy, is he got his own place, that he started his own thing, and there is this real kind of thread running through, Devil in a Blue Dress, That's actually a thread that goes back to, any of you know movies like Boys in the Hood from 1919,
yeah.
That famous gangster film? And in Boys in the Hood, there's that classic scene of, you know, why aren't there more black-owned businesses? Right? And that was a whole thing in the 60s, 70s, up through the 90s. And right, part of the problem with this is that we don't have this black capitalism that they talk about in Cotton Comes to Harlem at the end. And so there's this fascinating question about easy also being independent and making some money. The same thing goes with Do the Right Thing, right? Where's my 250, Sal? This idea of getting paid. You know, this idea of why aren't there black businesses? Hey, Sal, why aren't there any brothers on the wall, right? That's the whole freak out in Do the Right Thing. And it's kind of this real particular moment where, you know, Spike Lee himself is engaging with the question of what does it mean, you know, not only after the civil rights, but in a moment where, you know, you're dealing in a place like Bensonhurst, that would be the Italian section of Brooklyn, but Bedford Stuy, right? How you kind of deal with the question of race and ethnicity and the Italians and John Turturro in there. I mean, that's just a brilliant look at all that. But good point. I mean, the question of freedom, 112, right? And this is at the very end of that chapter. And this is when he's kind of doing his thing. And I looked around for Dupree. Who's Dupree? Quick thing about Dupree and who's
his worker,
Coretta. So worker, he worked alongside Dupree, and Dupree was at least one night he met him, he was hanging out with Coretta. What happened to Coretta?
She died.
She died. She was murdered. Right? And it seems like everyone after they had sex, right? And that sex scene was wild, right? It was very weird. I didn't always know what was happening, right? What's that? I needed the Cliff Notes. Anyway, it was interesting the fact that Coretta dies. Dupree is kind of in the picture, but not really. And there's a question about her murder. But everyone related, or he comes into contact over that 4 or 5 days that the action happens, seems to be getting murdered, right? I mean, we get with the intensity of that. But there's these moments like this at the end of chapter 9 on 112. I looked around for Dupree, but he was nowhere to be seen. This is the final paragraph. Not even at his station. That surprised me. And this is right after he quit his job. He basically told Benny that, you know what, I'm not going to kiss your ass. I'm not doing this job. I thought you wanted to take me back because I was a hard worker. If you don't, it's not going to be like I'm a slave on the plantation again. Go screw yourself. That surprised me, but I was too happy to worry about him. My chest was heaving. I felt as if I wanted to laugh out loud. My bills were paid, and it felt good to have stood up for myself. I had a notion of freedom when I walked out to my car. And that sentence, given the context of 1948 segregation, you know, not but 70 years before was the Civil War, right? Put that in some context. The question of freedom and what that meant as a black man in 1948 Los Angeles is very important. And this idea of him being an independent contractor or a detective and kind of rethinking history from that perspective is really powerful. I mean, and this is kind of an alternative universe than what we've experienced in this class so far. And I always love, he's talking about his pride, but also the pride before the fall. We talked about we alluded to the interrogation. But before we do, I want to find that part with the money. Because for me, it goes in nicely with what Paul Bond is talking about with the capitalism. Who remembers the part when they're talking about money is really the key? Because when you have money, I mean, he talks about it a few times. He talks about this question of the wealth and how the wealth is in some ways going to be the key for him to get out of his fix, right? Because without money, oh yeah, let's look at this because this is perfect. Chapter 14. And this is when, this is pages 142, 143, when Easy first hears what he calls the voice, right? What's the voice?
It's
apparent to me who's done the reading. I don't know if it's apparent to anyone else in this class. But very apparent to me. I love apparency. I love transparency. I'm sorry. Sarah, you were saying something? Did I interrupt you?
I just want to answer then.
Okay. No, answer, please. You're the only one who's answering.
That's not true.
No, you're right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Forgive me. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm a big fan of all of you who've done the readings. I'm sorry, Sarah, could you please answer for once in your life? I'm kidding. Come on. Don't be emo boiled on me. We got to get through this class.
Means.
I don't know what it means either, but it's fun to say.
I know what it means.
You are it. Gotta stay off Twitter.
Okay.
Don't get on Twitter after 9 o'clock.
You're the reason we have emo boiled.
Sarah,
I'm
can you just...
now. I mean,
yeah,
if anyone in here, please point it out.
I don't even remember the question.
Yeah, what was the question?
The voice.
It's like his consciousness, except for it has more balls than he does. And it's
that's
like,
right.
And knows what to do.
Do you watch NCIS?
No.
Oh. Well, the main character is always talking about, like, his gut. And it's like the same thing.
Yeah, it's almost like that little man in the gut from Double Indemnity. I got this little man. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, but I feel like it's also more of his, like, survival instinct from being in the war, too. Because my dad talks about stuff similar to that also. Like, I think it's a common, like, trait among soldiers. You know?
Among veterans, really.
Because it's never, like, he talks about how it's never, like, how the voice doesn't have lust or anything. It's never, like, a get ahead of the game. It's always, like, just stay in the game.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean...
The first time
what? And it's becoming apparent to me. This is awesome, Jess. But I mean, that's really well said, all three of you. The triangulate, the triumvirate. But this point that the voice is, it's not about lust, it's about the sense of survival. And I never linked it, I'm obviously not a veteran, but this idea of it linking back to if you're a soldier and you're a time of war.
I feel like Hemingway would have had the same thing if he wasn't an alcoholic.
I think you and Hemingway... have this thing going on. Well, Hemingway, you know, Hemingway may very, very well have talked about the voice because he was actually a combat veteran himself. I mean, very much in that space.
He's an ambulance driver. Actually.
Every book, but actually was in combat. You know, was an ambulance driver, but actually spent time in combat, was, you know, almost mortally wounded. I mean, but this idea of the voice is similar, is interesting, and this question of survival, you get right to it. I mean, you go on page 145, and it says it right there. The voice has no lust. He never told me to rape or steal. He just tells me how it is if I want to survive. Survive like a man. And I love that line. Not only survive, and, you know, obviously it's gendered and sexist, to possibly if you read it in the wrong way, or the right way, depending. But this idea of surviving like a man. For Easy Rollins in 1948, what does it mean for him specifically to be a man? And that's an interesting question. What's that? To own property is part of it, right? To have money is part of it.
Standing up to himself
to have the sense of dignity and respect. And there's this whole question of respect. You don't have to like me, but like with Mouse, people respect him.
Well, and like when he goes to talk to his boss and he's like, it's Mr. Rollins, I don't work for you anymore.
Yeah, and that's a brilliant scene. Let's go to that. I mean, and there's that brilliant...
Aren't you going
to
talk about the money?
Yeah, I want to talk about the money, but you guys are bringing up great points. Okay. Let's find the money and then we'll go back to that. But that's actually a really good point, this question of respect. And this idea of kind of what it means for Easy Rollins to understand himself as a man in this culture, right? And part of that is the question of power. Part of that is the question of independence. And part of that, and a large part of that, is this question of money, right? Having money and power, the two are often not separate. We saw it with Emmett Sprague and his family, right? All his money. And all the power that it buys him in the world of the Black Dahlia.
And indemnity only with the big...
Absolutely, with the corporations again. I mean, there is a kind of lapovers between the corporations that you see they're talking about in the beginning here, but also at the end of the book, right? Or in indemnity only. And so there's... And Carter as this kind of figure of corporate America that you could also see in indemnity only. So yeah, excellent point. Yeah, so let's find that thing with the money. Did you find the page yet, Sarah?
12.
I found a page that's different than the one that you wanted.
It's different from the one I wanted?
It's later on.
Okay. So we'll go to hold that page because we're going to follow up the later on with that. 112 was the one we did with him with the argument about that. 111, if you want to see where he's relating the factory to the plantation, that's on 111. Full paragraph towards the end of the page. When I asked me what I had to say, I told him I might have been a little nervous, but I told him anyway. Benny didn't care about it, what I had to say. He needed all his children to kneel down and let him be the boss. He wasn't a businessman. He was a plantation boss, a slaver, right? And that's where they get into the back and forth about respect that Brennan just brought up. But the question of money, I Don't Kill Children, that's the one with that boy. I have the marginalia. Maybe I'll find it. Hold on. Where's the one you were talking about?
167.
Okay, let's go there. Okay, read it for us. Oh, I have another one too, which is following up on yours. Good. Yes, you found the one I was looking for. I'm a big fan of yours.
Money bought everything. Money paid the rent and fed the kitty. Money was why Coretta was dead and why DeWitt Albright was going to kill me. I got the idea somehow that if I got enough money, then maybe I could buy my own life back.
Yeah, and there's this question that comes up again and again about money being the key. And also having a direct link to justice. Go to the next page, 168. Right? It's not that I had no feelings for the murdered man, and this is where he's talking about Richard McGee, who was dead, and he's with Daphne when he finds the body. I thought it was wrong for a man to be murdered, and in a more perfect world, I felt that the killer should be brought to justice, right? Which is kind of something we all agree about, right? But then he follows up with this. But I didn't believe that there was justice for Negroes. I thought that there might be some justice for a black man if he had the money to grease it. Money isn't a sure bet, but it's the closest to God that I've ever seen in this world. What do you make of that statement? How many of you agree with that?
Sounds like a double.
This is kind of a, there's a philosophy going on with Easy Rollins and Devil in a Blue Dress to some degree that comes up again and again. And he's white, too, right? And so you can't, the question of class and race here can't be completely separated, right?
It's like African-American capitalism, you know, the idea of it again and again. In all of them, how African-American people tried to kind of became historically more equal to white people in American society, and some of them choose different ways to achieve it.
Yeah.
Some of them tried to do it by creating movements and try to kind of fight it off by doing demonstrations like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, but looks like some of them just choose a different way, decided to kind of became richer than some white people, and by this became equal or more powerful than white people.
Well, it's funny. It's a philosophy that I think we've seen a couple of times now this semester. I talked about it a bit with Do the Right Thing and The Mayor, but we saw it in Cotton Comes to Harlem. At the end, there's this whole vision that by them getting a piece of the Italian syndicate's drug money, by them getting a piece of that power, they in fact, in some ways, were going to kind of be getting freedom through economic means, right? And there's this point where they talk about debt. Albright talks about debt. There's this great, remember that? Let's go to that, because this is great for a college student to hear.
Didn't say, I give you money, I own you.
That's right. Yeah, 148. Perfect. Let's look at this. This idea of God and money comes up again and again. And E.Z. Rollins referring to the only God he knows is that one related to money. 147. Who wants to read that starting at the bottom? Too late for that, Mr. Rollins? This is Albright talking. Maureen, yes.
Too late for that, Mr. Rollins. You take my money and you belong to me. I don't belong to anybody. We all owe out something, E.Z. When you owe out, then you're in debt. And when you're in debt, then you can't be your own man. It's capitalism. I got your money right here, Mr. Albright. I reach for my pocket. Do you believe in God, Mr. Rollins? What do you want, man? I want to know if you believe in God. This here is bullshit. I gotta go to bed. I made like I was going to turn away, but I didn't. I would have never knowingly turned my back on DeWitt Albright. Because you see, he continued, leaning slightly toward me, I like to look very close at a man I kill if he believes in God. I want to see if death is different for a religious man.
Huh. And we talked about God and obviously Nietzsche early on, which will come back in The Big Blow. But we talked about God again and again and his absence in a lot of these novels, right? That kind of idea. And God almost now, you know, for Rollins and for Mosley, becoming part and parcel of money and power. Right, the idea of God has everything to do with how much power and money you have. to some degree. But this notion of debt, why might this A, as a college student, keep this in mind? You want to be part of the capitalist system, keep going into debt. That's how they put a noose around your neck. And I know it, because I lived it. And you all know it, because we live it. This is the culture we live in right now. But the relationship between debt and freedom is a direct one. It is an absolute direct relationship. And he says it here. When you're in debt, then you can't be your own man. And E.Z. Rollins is all about being his own man. It's about defining himself as a detective, as a man, outside of the segregated vision of that. And he says, that's capitalism. It's a very interesting kind of critique. We have the big businesses, Albright, and we have Albright constantly coming back to this idea of capitalism. We even have E.Z. Rollins talking again and again about how money is the closest thing in this world he's seen to God, at least a God that will get him justice. And there's a really kind of, you know, interesting text going on here with Mosley. And, you know, what is some of this vision? And I hadn't realized it until we started talking about it tonight. I mean, I talked about that extensively in my blog post about Cotton Comes to Harlem. This idea of black capitalism and the emergence of that and things like, you know, and this might be, if I was writing a research paper on the work I've done, which I think I'm gonna, part of it is gonna be this kind of vision and noir of capitalism, and black capitalism specifically. Another point that comes up that we haven't really talked about, and this came up in the essay we read with by Nairmore, More Than Night, right? One of the things that Nairmore said in that essay that I think is really interesting, especially given that we have Mosley in 1990 writing a book from the point of view of an African-American soon-to-be detective, or emergent detective, right? He's becoming a detective in this book. And then he goes on to have 7 more books of E.Z. Rollins as the detective. Interesting thing about E.Z. Rollins as a character, he's never a licensed detective. Just like the juke joints or the bars he go to aren't licensed, right? He actually just a private eye, but he's not licensed, which I love that detail. I think he gets licensed later on in the series in like the 6th or 7th novel. But he's not a licensed he's not a licensed investigator. But this question of race, according to Nairmore, has always been at the heart of noir. At the heart of noir, particularly when dealing with the U.S., and dealing with our cultural history, and dealing with the 40s, and this return from war, and this return to this kind of suburban dream of the 50s of white America, what was being suppressed, and what was being ignored, and what was being elided from the narrative was the questions, I think, like the Zoot Suit Riot that Elroy starts his with, like someone like E.Z. Rollins, who potentially could be a historical figure, who found on a pier with 5 white kids, could find his death. That kind of vision of that moment, from a completely different cultural perspective that we haven't even imagined, is what for Nairmore was at the heart of the film noirs that oftentimes didn't even deal with black characters. And if they did, they were often in the background somewhere. And so there's this really interesting idea that the question at the heart of noir was something that was never actually on the screen, what they call non-diegetic, something you never see, right? The absent presence, right? The force you hear, that's never there though. And that's really interesting that, you know, come with Chester Himes too, but with Walter Mosley in some ways even more powerfully, we start to get and fill in that absent presence. Now, you can't revise the 40s and 50s. They happened. Those texts were made. That narrative was told. But as a point and an act from the 1990s or the 1980s, like we saw with Elroy and after Mosley, you can reimagine that past to inform your present. And that's what I really love about these kind of, you know, historical narratives, in which they tell us as much, and if not more, about 1990 than they do about the real history of 1948. They tell us about a culture that's trying to wrestle with a long 300 to 400, 500 year history of questions of race and slavery and struggle over identity and freedom and what that means. And it's interesting that, of course, that would in some ways be the 19th, the 18th, and the 20th century text of American culture and history. That's a struggle. It's a long history of what we're battling with. And sure, it's not the only one, but it is a dominant narrative that's defined us as a people for hundreds of years. And it's a kind of a remarkable moment to start reimagining that from a cultural perspective. And I think at its best, and Devil in a Blue Dress is certainly a great novel, and at its best, it's inviting us into that whitewashed history that we really didn't question. Right? Where did they come up in Mildred Pierce, in Double Indemnity, right? In John Fante, Hemingway, right? They did come up, and Hemingway was interesting. You did have that figure, particularly with the battler, right? There was that moment, right, of the other, of the racial other. And it's funny with Walter Mosley, like, we're starting to, in some ways, we're reading these narratives in these novels, right, in many ways, Albright's positioned as the other. The world in which you're existing as a reader is actually a black universe, as opposed to the predominantly white universe that every black person would have to experience as they were going to pop culture in the 40s and 50s and 60s. So there's a really interesting kind of reframing in the 1980s and 90s. That's an important moment. That's kind of hopefully informed part of who we are, you know? And this is not some Pollyanna story about, oh, great, and now we've dealt with racism. Let's move on to the next thing. Of course not. But this is a part of that narrative history. All right. And that question of capitalism that comes up again is really is compelling to me. Now, a couple of things. We will be watching Carl Franklin's Devil in a Blue Dress here at 6 o'clock sharp. Right? There may even be a little surprise for you. So be prepared. No, not dinner. A different kind of surprise. So get ready.
That's what I was thinking.
Depends what you mean by bad. If you've done the reading, it will be a bad surprise. Okay, and the other thing is...
I like Sarah's idea better.
What's your idea?
That's Sarah.
Dinner.
We're going to provide you with dinner?
Remember last time you were going to get a movie and you were going to bring dinner.
Remember the last time I said, let's do it outside of class, and everyone said, no way, Jose, I won't do anything with you
outside of
class.
You said yes, but then
there was a hurricane. There was a hurricane.
Don't give me this. Everyone was like, are you kidding me? I will never take my time where I'm sleeping. Everyone's always sleeping. I don't know why you're so jealous over your time for. Although I'm glad you did get some sleep, Brenna. I know you needed it. But more seriously, I mean, okay, we'll see. It may be a good surprise, it may not. Although I have to say, I mean, we'll meet at the final, so this isn't our last. But you guys have been a very fun group. Emo Boiled, and I know this has kind of been an experimental class, and some of you feel like I've made you read too much or pushed you too hard to write, but boo-hoo. That's what you're here for. Enjoy it. Make it. That's what you're doing. This is where you come, and the literature you read and the stuff you write is the armor of the world you'll take with you. This is how you understand who you are. This is that process. It's essential. And if you're not struggling through it, then you're not alive. That's the point. You know, let's struggle with this. Let's live in a world where we're engaged. It's fun. Anyway, I'll shut up. Point being, we have Wikipedia articles to finish. Ta-da! And guess who came to the rescue?
Paul Bond,
of course. So this is, and there may be a good surprise for you. Maybe a bad surprise for you. It may be both.
What? Is Paul Bond going to be the guy that's here?
Yeah. All right. A couple of things. This is by December 7th. You all need to have filled out your course evaluation. And I'm expecting there's 15 of you. There's no reason why you can't go to your email right after this class and fill out your course evaluation. I don't care what you say. I'll never see who said what. For the love of God, be honest. Give feedback. And, you know, help me make this course, which is this first run, better. Okay? The other thing is, so I'm expecting you to do that. If there's only 14 out of 15, you're going to see one angry professor. But that doesn't really matter because I won't know.
I know.
There's nothing I can do. That's right. There's no reprisal. But I'm just saying do it. Okay? Okay. But the other thing is the wiki editing. I've gave everyone feedback on their articles. Was that helpful? Did you guys get organized and start going after that? I sent it to everyone. You're looking surprised, Sabrina. Why?
I didn't get it.
Do you check your email?
Yeah, I do.
A big fan of yours. Did your sister or cousin share it with you?
I actually don't think I've been on your emailing list because I've, like, since you've been showing me emails. Like,
how come I'm finding that out? Week 15. This is unbelievable to me. Okay. We'll deal with this to some degree. Obviously, that group has not been talking. That's apparent. Okay.
Yeah, she didn't get it either.
I don't think I did, but I'm on your email list.
Yeah, I don't think I did.
I didn't get
this is absolutely, you. This is a coup against me.
I absolutely
got it.
You only did half of ours?
That's not true. I sent everyone on, like, elongated email about this is what you this is what you need to do.
But it wasn't specified.
Okay, I sent it. Here's, let's be clear. Everyone who was on the Google document, I sent it to that email.
Oh, well, I never checked that email.
I never ever check that email.
Go check that email. Are you kidding me? I gave you all sorts of feedback on where that article needs to be. I did that Friday. I stayed here late. Okay, so then check that. And groups, I'm not going to be here Thursday. You're going to be watching the movie. Between now and the end of this week, meet and make that article solid. The other thing is we got to start moving it over to Wikipedia. Do all of you have... The Sarah Paretsky group, Indemnity Only, shouldn't have too much of a problem because there's nothing there yet. That's an empty article. So you guys should be able to take what you've done in the article, in the document, move it over, and start formatting it. But I'm going to expect that that's there. The Double Indemnity article, that's already got an existing article, so Susanna and I have to bring that in kind of cleanly. The Glass Key article, it's the same thing. The stuff you've written, you have to kind of build on the article as it exists, right?
Can we not just erase it?
You don't, no, you don't erase it and write over it. No, that's not how Wikipedia works. It's a collaborative creation.
What if the person who did it first was dumb and then you don't want to collaborate with it?
That's not the point. The point is, what if they were dumb? I'm going to be better. Then start your own, blog and blog, right?
What if?
Start your own Wikipedia.
Let's start our own Wikipedia.
What if you took, like, the things that they had already said and then, like, expanded on that?
That's exactly what
you
do.
That's what he's saying to
you
do.
You build, you build on top of it. You
so
integrate it.
You don't necessarily have to leave, like, their same words or, like, their sentences.
Okay, so this is actually going to be important, and we're going to see, because you might, everybody in the group should have an account. What you're going to do is build on the existing article, right? So you're going to go in, and you're going to say, here's what we did. Let's build out this. Here's my resource. Here's my citation, etc. So, like I said, Indemnity Only won't have an issue because there's nothing there yet. Glass Key and Double Indemnity, which we're working on, but also Cotton Comes to Harlem, there's a stub there.
There's like one sentence.
Exactly. So that's going to be pretty easy for you guys to build on. I think for the Glass Key, there's not that much there.
Can we just leave it separate and be like, somebody else did this? Don't read this part.
No. This isn't, you have to edit their stuff. You have to be part of it. That's part of Wikipedia. And this is kind of, if I did this, and as I do this in coming semesters, I'm going to integrate the actual editing in more. And that's my failure, and I recognize that. But I want us, failure's good as long as you're learning from it.
Okay.
Learning. I sound like such an idiot when I say stuff like that. Failure's good. like a hippie, right? I should put on some patchouli and walk around like, it's everything's great. It's not true. There's, this isn't NOM. There are rules.
Pretty sure the hippies were against NOM, too. So.
Yeah.
We had to have this conversation like 2 months ago.
It always comes back to hippies.
Leah?
Yeah. I just meant that we have to work better.
Oh, yeah, like blogging?
Like
blogging. Okay, good point. Big fan of yours. I'm sorry.
Hopefully, did you enjoy my last one?
Yes, I did. You're right. I mean, I take that actually, I think that makes sense. But given this is what we're dealing with, I want you guys to get in there, start editing. Paul Bond, to get back to my original point, has a post on his blog where he shows you specifically how Wikipedia allows you to cite seamlessly within this. Now, this also means that with your citations, that's why you have to take all the information you get. The journal, the issue, all that information, and it's going to give you fields. You may not have to fill out all of them, but like with book citation or journal citation or new citation, That stuff's going to be there. Now, I want you to actually start importing this stuff over to Wikipedia, right, within the next week. So by next Tuesday, I want to start seeing these articles have signs of you all as Wikipedia authors building it in there. Does that make sense? What do you owe me on Thursday after you get whatever
the
little
paper.
Surprise? And
Rough draft.
And I will get that back to you by the weekend, and the final draft is going to be due on Thursday, finals week.
Should it be hard copy?
I want it on your blog, and I'll give you feedback by email. Yeah, do a rough draft on your blog. Right? That will be easier for me to get, and it's due by midnight on Thursday. Yes?
Oh, yes. About Thursday. What time do we have a final?
Thursday, it's at 7. And it ends at 9:30, I think. 7 at night to 9:30.
Is it
10?
No, it's 9:30.
It's 9:30.
Is it in our old room?
It's here. No, we'll have it
here.
Oh, maybe we could take the midterm down there and then come up and look at the Wikipedia. Where do you want it to be? Here or downstairs?
Downstairs.
Okay. We'll take the final downstairs and then we'll come up here and look at the Wikipedia. The final will probably be like the midterm. Let's talk a little bit of the final so you can prepare as you study. The final will be somewhat like the midterm. And am I kind of taxing anyone's time right now because it's 7:16?
I am,
aren't
I?
Unbelievable.
I'm joking, but I have a question.
Yes.
Is it cumulative? Like,
yes.
Okay. The whole year?
We will be focusing on the second half. The text, it will have things, obviously, will link back, so I don't want to say forget about what you did the first half.
Like Hemingway?
Like, you know, that stuff may come up. I don't think I'll be asking you short answer or identifications about them, but the essays will link back to what we talked about in the beginning. And I'll give you an example by the weekend of what to look for, like I did with the midterm, so there will be no surprises. You'll get a sample of what we talked about. Did that help with the midterm?
Yes.
Okay. What are we talking about? What are the texts we've read since the midterm? List them for me.
Indemnity only
is one. What else?
Devil of Dubas.
What?
Mildred Pierce.
Mildred Pierce, we actually have in the midterm.
Oh.
Strangers on a Train.
Black Dahlia.
Devil in a Blue Dress.
Black Dahlia.
Cotton Comes to Harlem. Black Dahlia.
In Our Time.
In Our Time was before.
In Our Time was the first thing we did.
Oh, I thought
you
meant the whole
year. Okay, let's do it. Let's do it chronologically since the midterm. No, it's not your bad.
Wait, no, it is.
Yeah.
No, it's going to be cumulative, but that's going to be mainly for the essays. The identification and short answer are going to be from the midterm on.
Was Cotton?
Cotton comes. Okay, let's start cumulative. The first thing we read was Strangers on a Train.
Yes.
And then what?
Cotton comes to Harlem.
And the movie. And the distinctions between the two. We've blogged about it. We've talked about that.
Then Indemnity Only.
Then? No.
Yes.
Is Indemnity Only? Yes. Indemnity Only.
Black Dahlia,
Black
yeah.
Devil in a Blue Dress, and what is
Big Blowdown?
The Big Blowdown.
Why do you keep saying the Big Blow?
Big
Blowdown.
He's abbreviating it.
Is that why
are you questioning my authority in front of all
these
people? Why do you want to make me cry?
I'm going to do that.
I am. Why do you want to make me be emo boiled?
I'm just saying.
That's Connor's
every
job.
Every time you've brought it up, it's been the Big Blow. Even when you tweeted me, you were like, you should read the Big Blow by George Pelly, blah, blah, blah. And I was like,
Pelicanos.
It's Big Blowdown, but
why do you have to yell at me? Why you don't like me, Connor?
Because he's emo boiled.
For life. Okay. So.
Big
Blow, or Big Blowdown, as Connor says.
It's on the cover.
Is it just because it's on the cover doesn't make it right. That's awesome. But the Big Blowdown, what is our situation with that book?
Extra credit.
Blog about why it's in the class, why you ordered it, and extra credit.
See, someone read my email. Did you guys all at least get my email about where we got to go from beginning to end from here?
Yeah, because we send that to our real email address.
Yeah. Good point.
Why you got to be so mean to me? All right, this is not the end, though. We're going to meet finals week. Any questions before we break tonight?
You should have pizza.
Yeah, we'll see.
Well, finals, no problem. I might even do a little something for Devil in a Blue Dress. Attendance will be taken. You are expected to write this movie, and this movie will also be on the final.
So the final of our paper, just turn it in on the day of the final?
Turn it in. It's your passport to get to the final.
So that you want hard copy?
No, I want it on your blog. I don't want anything hard copy.
Which one?
So why? How can it be our passport?
Yeah, English.
Electronic passport.
It's electronic. I can see. I can go to your blog as you walk in and say, oh, Jess, you didn't blog anything.
And then
yep, she wouldn't be talking about me.
No, that's the other Jess. I always want to call you Jess, not Jesse.
You have both the rough draft and the final paper on her block.
That's right, yeah. What do we need to kill trees for?
So true.
This is 21st century.
Why can't we email?
Why can't you put it on your blog?
Because then everyone else will read it.
I want other people to read it.
We don't.
Speaking of good points.
Who else would read our blog besides him anyway?
It's seven. What's up?
I said, speaking of good points, can we go?
Oh, interesting. Everybody but Jesse, feel free to go. Okay. No, you guys are great. Good night. You can go. And DS106 Radio.
Oh, yeah,
thank
we
you
need
for
a
listening.
Blue book?
Yes, bring book blue books to the final, please.
Oh, yeah.
DS106 Radio, Emo Boiled, signing out.